Hi, I'm Bob Fisher, and I'm your host today on This is Design Intelligence. Carol Ann Colbert has had a career dedicated to creating effective and rewarding workspaces. Beginning her career as an interior designer in firms, she eventually went to work for clients. Most recently, the Global Director for Workplace Strategy and Innovation for the Coca-Cola Company, she also served as Senior Real Estate Advisor for Chevron and Managing Director at JLL. On this edition of This is Design Intelligence, she talks about how ideas have changed around what makes an effective workplace, how the design community can create optimal experiences for workers, and the question that begins any successful workplace design.
Welcome to this edition of This is Design Intelligence, conversations with leadership voices in the built environment.
Carol Ann Colbert, welcome to This is Design Intelligence. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks, Bob. Pleasure to be with you. I always look forward to our conversations, and this one especially.
Well, I think this one is going to be a good one for our listeners because it's all about the future of workplace. And your career, you've seen a lot of different trends sort of come and go, different ways of thinking about workplace design come and go. Let's start by telling us the story that's both your progression throughout your career and what was kind of going on in the world and in the mind of workplace design through those periods.
Sure. So thank you for going back to 100 years ago for me. That was just lovely of you, Bob. I joined the industry with a degree in interior design in the 80s. And at that point in time, we were still, depending upon who you talk to, in love with a cube farm. And I spent the early part of my career in the push-pull between open and closed, open office landscape, and so forth, and had the great privilege to work across a spectrum of clients. But it didn't take me too long to realize that for me, as we were going through that workplace journey, design might not be my end game. And I found myself gravitating toward initially planning, which grew into the early days of space planning. And along that progression, I found myself in the supply and demand equation, really at the real estate end of things. Because I think all of us as designers inherited projects that we realized were rather flawed from the outset. Decisions were made long before they got to our desks. And so that was my journey through it. And you can't talk about workplace without talking about the supply and demand of real estate. How much do you have? Where is it? Is it the right amount? Is it the right quality? And you can't talk about it without thinking about the technology and the digitization that has been parallel to that journey. And so if we think about it, in whether or not we talk about it in actual workplace trend language, whether it's open office, which grew into activity base, which is actually rather brilliant in its day because we were really looking at how work got done, moving all the way fast forward to here we are thinking about hybrid, at the heart of all of those conversations is really a discussion around open, closed, personal or private versus community versus co-creation space versus, you know, adding the well-being dimension to it. And at the end of the day, we have just been on one really long learning journey. And if I learned anything or feel like I know any truths about that, it would be that the best clients I've had over the years, whether on either side of that equation, have been the clients that we took the time to bring on that learning journey with us. Why were we doing for them or suggesting for them what we were suggesting in the depth of the knowledge that we'd gained? And I think that this has been just one long journey, and I really feel like toward better and better solutioning around human-centric design. And so it's fascinating. We could probably talk about that one piece as it means different things around the world, or it has different nuances around the world, but the fundamentals are the same.
It sounds like when you first got into the industry as a young designer, that people were thinking about work almost in binary terms.
Very.
Right? So it was either cube farm, solo, or more of an open plan. So it was open versus closed.
And for many, there was no difference. If you said open plan, that was, oh, they're just trying to put me in a cube. There was no softening of that message for a number of years.
You mean among the people who had to work in the spaces?
Exactly.
Well, as time went along, it sounds like more and more ideas and discoveries were introduced, and the definition of what made for a good workplace kept evolving and changing. And in your characterization, it was becoming better and more enriching. As you watch that progression from where you started to, you know, ultimately where the whole world of workplace design arrived, what was the role or the place of the actual person working in the space? Like, how much were they considered at the beginning? Did they grow in influence? Like, what was the role of the actual user of the space?
Well, I think that's really interesting question, in the sense that very often there was a predisposition on the part of your client as to how much voice the actual user had. And because underlying all of that, if you go back mid-century, is this desire for efficiency and standardization, which when you think about it, is the dilemma we're solving, right? And so how do you make it both human scale and seamless user friendly and still become efficient in the real estate that you have? And so some clients were very, very focused on thinking about it, and hence we developed very good skills around programming. And it had to fit the business. Obviously, we couldn't do anything that in any way harmed the business. And if you weren't thinking about the user, you were at great risk to harm the business. I think programming is an interesting conversation, in that it also inhibits innovation. And so, you know, we started with Henry Ford. You can go back there. But innovation is key to what we're doing. And so I think we are getting closer and closer to better sociometric science that will let us actually measure behaviors in the workplace, ones that are reported to be good versus ones that are proven to be successful. And I think there's a nuance there.
So tell me more about the difference between proven to be successful and reported to be good.
Surveys are self-reported. And a lot of times when you are in programmatic surveys, you're asking people what they do. And what they do is occurring in the construct of what they have, right? And so it's a little bit of a catch-22 when what they tell you that they're doing in the construct of what they have, and you're intending to innovate, and the environment in which they do their work will change, then you also need to be actually physically measuring whether or not it's presence in the space, usage of spaces, usage of equipment, actual sociometric measurement. How much are they interacting with their coworkers? Can we tell about the quality of those interactions? And we are building data more readily around that today than we ever were before. So I think it's going to be an interesting dynamic how we begin to use this wealth of data that we're getting to truly inform the solutions that fit the experience we're trying to deliver.
So does it come down to the difference between what people experience and they think they do versus what they actually do?
Very much so. Very much so. There's oftentimes a disconnect there, and it shows up, for example, and this is the old conundrum, but I think it hasn't quite gone away, is, okay, if you look at the data, it tells us that our conference rooms were in use 75% of the time. Were they? No. So the intention was there, the intent to meet, the intent to be together, but the reality of it was quite different.
It sounds like in order to get the right kind of data, that what you need to do is both be in close connection with the users of the space, but also have some other more kind of observational ways of collecting data that really don't have to do with the self-report problem.
All of the above. It's a triangulation, Bob, and it would be, I think it's a huge mistake to follow one piece of data or one data feed.
When in your career did you first start using more sophisticated research in order to help make decisions about real estate and about workplace for the organizations you work for?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I can't think of a time when I wasn't curious and through research and or industry outlets looking for what other people were doing, seeing, and experiencing as they delivered space. I will tell you, if we talk about more recent times, the things that we knew and the research would tell us, the question becomes how much applies today given the dynamics we're in with remote work and so forth. So I think that's an interesting sort of dilemma there.
Now, in the different industries that you worked in, you've worked both on the design side and you've worked kind of on the owner side. And even on the owner side, you worked in different industries. Was there any difference in the workplace design based on the industry as opposed to simply the time period that you were in and what the most advanced contemporary thinking was?
Profoundly so. You know, I was with Chevron for a number of years. Who goes to work for Chevron? Physicists, technologists, chemists, biologists, geologists. That creates a pool of talent that has different needs than who goes to work for Coca-Cola. And so it is profoundly different what people do and why they are in the workplace at all. So industry is hugely influential. The next part of it is the cycle of the business of that industry. Some industries are particularly short-cycled, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 12, financial services. That during my time in financial services, it went from a 36-month cycle to a 6-month cycle. You know, oil and gas, 25, 35-year cycles. And how a company decides and makes decisions inside their business cycle relative to the risk and the cost of their business is, I think, the second factor. So we, in the design community, we need to be educated on what drives the business we're attempting to serve and deliver space for.
So by the business cycle, basically what you mean is in the normal work of what an organization does, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end to what kind of service they provide, or kind of you might be able to think of it as a project, but that's probably too small, and that there are these very big differences in the different industries that you have served.
Projects in oil and gas, it takes about 15 years from discovery to first oil or gas. So that's one project, and it has 6 key phases, right? A project at Coca-Cola was 6 months. You know, we had a new formula. You're going to bring a new product out. Speed to market is everything. Financial services, a different cycle. And so, yes, they're projects, but sort of really looking under the hood of what phase of the project, a particular space, are you designing space for the end-to-end project, or are you designing space for a phase of the project? And I think that's particularly important when you get into heavy technology type industries.
Gotcha. So what are some of the other factors that you think it's important for us to consider when we're conceiving of, you know, an appropriate workplace environment for a given client or industry?
Why are they there? What does the company expect to happen in this workplace that will be so incredibly valuable to that company that they will continue to invest not only in new space, but to continue to invest in having places for their employees to work. And so if you can understand why they're there and what they must accomplish while they are there, then you can start to think about the solutions that meet those needs. Now, much of talent is fungible, much of talent necessary to run. Well, I say that today, AI may be certainly changing this, but in the knowledge sector work, in white collar work, many functions are fungible. Those are easy. Those are not so hard. When you get into the specializations and the true innovators in companies, that's where I think particular focus has to be, because companies that are not learning and innovating successfully within, then that company doesn't have a future. And it's our jobs to make those spaces super functional for them and meet their needs.
There seems to be a lot of wondering and discussion around the place of community in the work that people do and the place of individual contribution. One way to think about it is having a workplace where people interact quite a bit and having a workplace where people really do heads down or focused work and maybe some combination of those things. And it could be that I'm just creating a binary situation where it isn't, you know, and that there are many more types of work than that. Tell us a little bit about your ideas around community and kind of individual and how we balance those out in the workplace. Are there any kind of general principles that we can go off of?
It's not a zero-sum game and it's not binary. I think your observation there is correct. The myth of the lone scientist creating and innovating in a vacuum is truly that. It's a myth. Even our most introverted single performers do need to thrive in whatever level of community they can and will be inspired to participate in. We learned, and it was a wonderful quote from Shell Oil about the need for their scientists who much preferred an office, individual performers, you know, top of the game. They needed to be available and interacting with their younger scientists. So the preference of the individual is, and we want to make them most productive, but we also want them to be available to mentor and help that next group of scientists behind them. So where we got to, I think I think you and I touched on this in talking about what we did at Coca-Cola. There's four things we kind of hit on, and we had a really, you know, a little catchphrase that we were talking with leadership about, and it's basically the four C's that we were trying to hit were collaboration, co-creation, community, and concentration. And depending upon the group, depending upon the country, depending upon the city, depending upon the commute patterns, you would work to deliver greater or lesser amounts of those types of spaces. What worked, you know, during the pandemic and post-pandemic in Asia is a different mix of those types of solutions than it is in the United States or Latin America for that matter. So it's not an either or. You're absolutely right. You really need to think about the four in a bucket of four, in my view, Carol Ann's view of the world there.
Well, it's a very informed view. I mean, you've earned it.
Well, we'll see.
So tell us about the balance that we need to hit between the experience of people who are users of a space and all of the other practical considerations that one might think of as coming from the organization or the company that they work for. I imagine sometimes those line up beautifully and sometimes those might be in conflict.
Very much so. But I think increasingly, and this is good news for the industry, there is an unprecedented and almost uniform focus on employee experience right now. And I think it's leading us into what I think of as experiential design. The tricky part, Bob, is that the employee's experience of the company, it has many, many threads. And if we think, and space is one of them. But when you come into space versus when you are working remotely on Monday, you're in space on Tuesday and Wednesday, you're remote Thursday and Friday, is your experience of the company's technology the same? How seamless is it? And so you can have a great working experience with your own home setup and go into the office and have a miserable experience with the technology there. And the space itself can be lovely, wonderful, and welcoming. And so we can't, as a design community, not be joined at the hip in understanding what the employee experience is in other parts of the company that we have no control over. We used to say at Chevron that we could design all the most wonderful space in the world, but if the policies and protocols of the company did not encourage people to use the space to the fullest extent of the design, we'd missed. And so now we are, I think, very focused on the experiences, those four C's that we want people to have when they come into the office. But, you know, are there, you know, are they being compelled to be in the office? Are they, you know, what's that experience when they get there? Is the food good? Is it hot, cold, comfortable? What natural light do we have? So I try to think and encourage us to, if we don't get the answers, we have to at least ask them. And we need to make sure we're asking a lot of right and holistic questions that, quite frankly, some of our from our business contacts or client contacts, well, why do you need to know that? Well, there's some really good reasons designers need the whole picture. We have the opportunity to mitigate some things, but some things being beyond our control, this is where we're going back to educate the client, is how all of this is an interconnected set of workplace strategies.
Gotcha. Folks on the design side would probably really love to believe that the design and the organization and shaping of space then has a direct effect on shaping and encouraging positive behaviors. But as you were just saying, there's so many factors that go into whether or not somebody has a good experience with a workplace. What is the right role, or how should the design community look at their part of that overall experience piece? And beyond just asking the right questions about other dimensions of the employee experience, what else can people in the design community do to maximize the benefit or the positive effect of their designs?
Wow. I do believe that beautiful spaces, well-designed spaces that inspire people can be deeply influential in the physical interaction that people have with each other and the space. I think that is, we all respond to art, we all respond to nature, and well-done spaces are equally evocative. That said, I think the design community tends to get sometimes put in a box. And so even if we're not a part of those discussions, encouraging our clients to bring key stakeholders into the visioning of a space it's a tactic, but visioning is incredibly important. And getting the right stakeholders into early visioning is a role that most designers would not have seen for themselves, but it is tremendously powerful. And so quite possibly eye-opening, because they will hear things about priorities. And I distinguish visioning from programming. Very, very different. We even got to a place at Coke where we stopped programming altogether. We concentrated on a very robust visioning session and had great success with that, but we had the right stakeholders at the table. So I would say where you play in that equation in delivering wonderful space, getting more conversant around those visioning and having, when you have that multiple group of stakeholders, they will answer from their point of view and they will give you insights that are not necessarily readily apparent to be design related, and yet you will find yourselves using that input to great value. For example, around storytelling and conveyance of culture and what technologies are the most important versus which technologies are the bells and whistles in their view. And so I think it's a high value activity the design community really needs to lean into.
So the technology people need to be in the room. Some representatives of the actual users of that space need to be in the room.
Yep.
Who else needs to be in the room?
HR. HR needs to be in the room. And the facility team, if you can get a senior enough level person from the facility side, because there is a growing trend on the facility side of the business to have their facility people really step into and leaning into being more of a concierge for the space. And if they're vested and buy into the features and the certain aspects of the space that they may not ever have thought of before, if they hear it in the voice of their occupant that these things are important, it becomes important to them as well. We're not the ones dictating what's important and what's not. And so if you can get those constituents in there, and last but not least, I might also want public affairs to be involved. That totally depends on the industry. If your client is a huge, if it's going to be a customer-facing facility and it's an important sales tool to back to the community and their customers, you may well want public affairs in the room at certain intervals, not every meeting.
Well, that's wonderful. That gives us a fantastic idea of how to get started with the right vision.
Well, that vision, those people in that room, if they believe they've been listened to, they will be the champions of any innovation that you want to offer.
Fantastic. So when you were head of workplace strategy at Coca-Cola, you were in the midst of trying to help create a new strategy for how the company would approach workplace when COVID hit. Tell us a story about what that experience was like and what you did to pivot your efforts and where you ultimately wound up with a workplace strategy for Coke.
Sure. I always like to say workplace strategy is not a singular, it's a plural. We, just like everybody else, when we walked out the door, when we were sent home, you had a laptop, and Coke's view very early on, we knew we weren't going back anytime soon. They decided to be the company that was not going to continually be moving the goalposts of reentry. The situation around the world was just too dynamic. And so it literally bought us time. And it also, I think I mentioned to you, it accelerated an already planned complete reorganization of the company. And so in reorganizing the company, once again, we went from, and we didn't have to solve space for this. We were an observer and a part of the reorganization. We went from a decentralized model of business delivery to a more centralized model of business delivery, which meant productizing teams instead of, if you were in Brazil, you did everything for Coca-Cola in Brazil, all products included. Now, Coca-Cola was a product. Bottled waters are a product, fruits, dairy. Those became centralized in verticals, and we went from a locally based company to most of our key teams were distributed over multiple time zones. So that kind of set the table for us to say, we cannot look back. We cannot ask people what they want or need because they will describe that to us in terms of what they know. And so we very early seized on the opportunity to really try to innovate. And we had the time to do something that I almost had never been able to do in my career, and that is listen. And so we went back to our five top, you know, all pencils down around the world on everything, right? So we went back to our five top design firms And we said, tell us what you think. What do you see? How do these things that are happening socioeconomically around the world change your view? And after that series of listening sessions, we did the very same thing with our top furniture manufacturers' think tanks. What do you see? How do you think this is going to change things? And when you think about the open and close that was happening around the world and the enormous uncertainty around that, it allowed us to take this big step back and think about that why question. Why will people come back if we had a bad quarter in 2020? In 2021, we made more money, but we had the highest revenue, best quarter the company had ever had. And so remote work was not a failure. And so what if people will come back to the office into the wonderful Coke celebratory environment we've always been so proud of, why will they be coming back? And what is going to be so commute worthy that they will do it? And we decided to lean into experiential design. And that's where those four C's came from. They're not going to come back for free food. We've been offering free food and beverages for years. That was not going to make that commute worthy. You know, average commutes in Japan are an hour and 30 minutes one way. So what were you going to do? And we hit on the notion of experiential design. We rolled out a framework of 5 to 6 experiences that we wanted to concentrate on. And Coca-Cola was amazingly supportive, and our leadership was supportive of rolling these out as pilots around the world to test, to learn. And we've been able to whittle down to focus on 4 experiences. And back to your point a moment ago, remote work was not successful everywhere in the world, and it will not be, even going forward, regardless of technological innovation, because housing units are smaller. They are multifamily, multigenerational. Families live in single housing units, which is not conducive to conference calls or podcasts or these things. And so you have to provide for those concentration elements as well. And I think that, and coupled with with new sociometric sciences to help us and measure how we're really doing in those, is enormous win. But inside of that, and we talk about a workplace strategy as being a static thing, we very much believe, and I believe is still true today, there's no such thing as a strategy. It has to be an evergreen framework that allows you to continue to respond and to innovate. And that is the push-pull of efficiency and standardization seems like a counterweight to that. But I believe it's going to be that that's sort of the new and healthy dynamic tension is between doing this at, you know, offering innovation at scale efficiently. If that sounds like an oxymoron, it probably is. So.
Well, not necessarily. You know, and it's interesting as I think back to you telling all the stories of all the different approaches and experiences you've had in this whole consideration of workplace gets me to wondering what you think the future holds for the concept of a workplace and what are the considerations that the design community is going to have to keep in mind as this future unfolds.
I honestly, if we go back, and I'm going to rely on the formula, we have to understand what work looks like before we can solve for place. And I think we are entering into, for lack of a better phrase, I would say sort of a wild, wild west here for the next few years. Obviously, AI is going to be enormously impactful to how work gets done and to current work streams and workflows. And that's going to land, in my view, this is Carol Ann's view of the world, largely on knowledge work. And hopefully the positive voice is that it will be all more or less a positive experience. But as that happens, if AI is really going to impact knowledge work, it's robotics that's really going to impact manufacturing and product work. And that's already, we're seeing that today. So if we think about how work is going to change over the next a little bit here, there's going to be a lot of upskilling and reskilling and change. That's not to say that you still need to focus on why will people want to come together in the midst of what may or may not be for them a fair amount of uncertainty. And that is, that means collaboration and the personal connections that you make while making decisions, co-creation, the energy and the fun and the excitement and the inspiration of that. It certainly may be AI enabled, but to do that and to drive that as group activity, that's a purpose of space. And then the wins, whether or not they're the individual win, the team win, the company win, celebrating those things is still going to be important and perhaps more important than it's ever been in order to foster culture. And so I think, you know, some of those fundamentals about why people come together aren't going to change, but we're headed into some real uncertainty about the work itself.
It sounds like the future is going to be fast moving, that in order to be successful, organizations are going to have to be very nimble, but they're also going to have to be very self-aware so that they understand and can answer these fundamental questions like, why do we come together? Well, I feel like we're just starting to scratch the surface, but I think this is a good place for us to wind up, at least until someday when we can have another part of this conversation. Would love to hear more from you.
Absolutely. Thank you for the time. Love being with you. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of This is Design Intelligence. The producer is Laura Spells. The sound engineer is Jared Knabel. This has been a DI Media Group production.